Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Fergal Armstrong, and welcome to Cracking Addiction. We have with us Dr. Manu Bhatnagar. Manu, I thought today we'd talk about the non-stimulant treatment of ADHD when we're thinking purely about the pharmacology. And I suppose, really, I just want to follow on from the previous episode and recap on this idea of the inverted pyramid in terms of reuptake inhibition. So we've got cocaine and amphetamines, which inhibit the reuptake of all the three main monoamines, serotonin, noradrenaline, and dopamine. Then we've got the stimulant methylphenidate, which inhibits the reuptake of noradrenaline and dopamine. And then we've got atomoxetine, which is a NARI, as you say, which is a noradrenaline reuptake inhibitor. But that's not the whole story, because we have this other range of drugs which are non-stimulants. So I'm thinking particularly of clonidine and guanfacine. So tell me about the role of clonidine and guanfacine in ADHD.
I use clonidine relatively often. Clonidine is not by any means psychotropic medication when it was first invented. And it's about lowering blood pressure. And the added side effect of clonidine when you're trying to lower someone's blood pressure is that they start sleeping really well. Insomnia seems to be a very common symptom that's maybe not in the DSM criteria for ADHD, but definitely within that syndrome of someone who's neurodiverse and experiencing inattention as a result of ADHD. Yeah. And the hypothesis of that may be that if you're not really spending a lot of focus on particular things throughout the day, maybe you're not exerting yourself from a cognitive sense throughout the day, and you need to sort of have a bit more time at the end of the day to do more things until you get more tired. And there's also that very strong underpinning link to ADHD and delayed sleep phase disorder.
Yes, I was going to say that. Yeah. Yeah. Delayed sleep phase is the curse of being an adolescent. But in ADHD, it's even more exacerbated, both because they've got ADHD and also because they're taking stimulants.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could you comment on that?
It's one thing that, you know, as a society in Scandinavia, if you are a high school student, you get to go to school at 10 a.m. and finish at 6 p.m., which means you take your stimulant medication at 9:30 so that you have your natural waking day where you have stimulants. And for teenagers, we're waking them up at 6 o'clock to take their Ritalin so that they can get ready for school, which starts at 8:30. And their natural sleep cycle is completely out of whack to begin with. It's just getting confused even more. So that's where saying to someone you need to take stimulants isn't enough. Having a multimodal approach to all of the different facets of ADHD is really vital. And that could be, you know, focusing on what time to take their stimulants, but also making sure that they get good sleep. So clonidine is really effective for that sort of mild level of unwinding and anti-agitation, as opposed to a hypnotic drug, which will just knock you out and not allow you to enter the full stages of your sleep architecture. Clonidine, the hypothesis is it's a vasodilator, and it sort of reverse engineers relaxation by vasodilating just before you're about to go to bed. And that causes you to basically unwind and relax enough that the normal sleep processes can take over. And for someone who's quite hyperactive and impulsive, that's really vital to get to bed at a reasonable time. Some do take it earlier on just to kind of take the edge off from the hyperactivity component, but predominantly clonidine's used as an augment for nighttime at about 100 or 200 micrograms, and people get wonderful results. Even if you don't have ADHD, some people can find it.
Yeah.
But the rates just...
So there's a lot to tease out of what you said. Firstly, what I really like hearing is that it helps you get to sleep, but it doesn't help you get to bed.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've still got to have the psychosocial construct, the support to actually get to bed. So, now, you know, for me, clonidine, I understand clonidine as an alpha 2 receptor agonist. So what does that mean? So for me, it means that it shuts down the noradrenergic release from the hypothalamus. So effectively, it switches off the neurological component of effectively the flight or fight response. Now, admittedly, there is another component from circulating adrenaline, but you know, when the mind is active, it's all about the noradrenergic outflow from the hypothalamus. And that's also one of the reasons why we use clonidine in addiction medicine, because it helps alleviate some of the symptoms of opioid withdrawal, which are also mediated by this noradrenergic output. One of the consequences of the use of clonidine is, as you say, vasodilation. So not only does it shut down the noradrenergic release, it shuts down that internal dialogue associated with the almost like the anxiety. It's very like anxiety, this internal dialogue. So clonidine helps with that, but it also, as you say, helps with vasodilation. And we've got to remember that the first half of sleep is all about vasodilation. You cannot fall asleep if you are not peripherally vasodilated. Because what has to happen with your core body temperature is it has to fall. And the only way that your core will fall is if your peripheries are warm. And the only way that your peripheries get warm is if you are vasodilated, which is why I say you can't sleep with cold feet. You need wet bed socks. But clonidine is effectively the pharmacological bed socks to a certain extent. So what can you say about, so do you remember Stahl?
I do remember Stahl. I think I'm getting a vivid flashback from medical school for the trauma that is that textbook.
Well, for me, it was a joy to read that textbook. But anyway, one of the things that Stahl talked about was the signal to noise ratio.
Yeah.
Whereby, you know, a high signal to noise is when you're tuning a radio and you get a very clear signal with very little background noise, but a low signal to noise ratio is when you turn the knob slightly and you get all this background static, which obliterates the signal, and so you can't really hear the radio properly. And so ADHD has been likened to a condition whereby you have a low signal to noise ratio. And Stahl, now I'm sure anyone listening will correct me if I'm wrong, but my memory of this is that Stahl said that stimulants decrease the background noise, whereas alpha 2 agonists, and I'm including in that guanfazine, otherwise known as Entunav, and clonidine, they increase the signal. So either way, you are basically augmenting the signal to noise ratio, and therefore you're allowing salience. Because one of the concepts of ADHD, it's a disorder of, well, you know, is it a disorder of salience? I defer to your psychiatric assessment on that.
Yeah, oh, definitely. And you know, it's not just about not being able to focus. It's about not being able to weigh up what you need to focus on because there's so much background noise. So I think that in the theory completely fits with what we're seeing clinically.
Yeah. Yeah. So we all kind of have a lot of experience using clonidine for various reasons, but the new kid on the block is guanfazine. It's also an alpha 2 agonist, otherwise known as Entunav, but I haven't used it. So what can you tell me about a guanfazine?
I haven't used it much either because at the moment with regulations in Australia, it's only PBS indicated for children and it's very expensive otherwise. And so it's not really something that many people would be prescribed in the adult setting for sure, but it could be an important adjunct just as if clonidine is. One important thing about guanfazine, because it is a stimulant, if you want a second agent, it's a fantastic adjunct because it doesn't contribute to all of the potential side effects that stimulants can. And having it just before bed means that you're sort of dividing doses of your treatment by 12 hours, which is a lot easier to maintain. In the pediatric population, when they are diagnosed with ADHD, some people are even having it as a first line because there's good evidence of having a good night's sleep and having that adrenergic control at nighttime makes for less hyperactivity the next day. So the evidence that's coming out in the pediatric population is that the hyperactivity component, if that's quelled enough, then someone can be settled enough at school to then do the rest of the work with the supports that they already have without having to put them through the sometimes really difficult side effects of weight loss and dry mouth and anxiety and agitation that can come with Ritalin or other stimulant medications.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I'm not I'm not an expert on guanfazine, but I was told that guanfazine has a longer duration of action than clonidine. Is that true?
Yeah, because it's a once daily dose at nighttime. So stimulant medications, when you take them in the morning, you know, lisdexamfetamine or long-acting Ritalin, they're once-daily doses, but the effect kind of tapers out at 4 or 5 p.m. And the idea is that you take them in the morning and you do the activity that you're doing throughout the day, be it school or work, and after hours, relax, it's out of your system, you don't feel the effect anymore, but you also don't need to be productive. So they're once a day, but they aren't 24 hours a day in terms of effect. Guanfacine does have that prolonged effect. Not only the first time you take it, maybe up to 16 hours, but as it builds a steady state up to about 5 days, people do report that round-the-clock reduction in agitation and the motor symptoms of ADHD and a building capacity to have a good night's sleep.
So it's much longer acting than clonidine, because I do note that clonidine's half-life is 12 to 16 hours. So I think that with clonidine, you know, if at the right dose, get a good night's sleep, which, as we've already discussed, is really vital. Talking about sleep, and we've also brought up this issue earlier, we talked about this concept of the sleep cycle, the circadian rhythm. I mean, there's another drug that is commonly used almost to alleviate the potential side effects of ongoing arousal with stimulants, and that's melatonin. Now, what's your view on the role of melatonin in this kind of treatment space?
It's pretty effective for someone who definitively has delayed sleep phase disorder. So, you know, if you're sleeping a little bit later and you're not occupied enough during the day, that doesn't quite meet the mark. And going to a sleep physician and having a proper assessment for delayed sleep phase disorder is really important. And if that's true, melatonin in conjunction with lifestyle modification and light box therapy does wonders in order to sort of retrain your brain about the appropriate time to go to sleep. So I think as a part of a bigger strategy, it's great, but only really for a few months while you're doing the other things. It's not really something you take every night for a long time to get good sleep.
I have issues with people who say to me, I need my kids' long-term melatonin, please will you prescribe it to me. Melatonin is actually one of the molecules that in mammals that have cyclical fertility periods, i.e. that are fertile during the spring and summer and infertile during the autumn and the winter, melatonin is actually the hormone that suppresses gonadal function. One of the reasons why we don't, as children, have any kind of sexual function is because the pineal gland secretes a constant amount of melatonin, right, albeit at night. But that concentration of melatonin compared to body weight ratio that is so high during prepubescent life, that is sufficiently high to actually suppress gonadal function. So one of the reasons why we actually experience puberty at the age of 14 is because we're growing and our body mass is increasing, and therefore relatively our concentration of melatonin affecting the gonads is reducing. So that's just one thing that I'm thinking about behind my, when I'm thinking about melatonin, that, you know, it's licensed for the short-term management of sleep phase disorder. So would you give melatonin long-term to someone who's experiencing the side effects of stimulants?
No, the way I use melatonin and the way I describe it to a patient is I think of this as training wheels for your brain. And you've lost the ability to know when it's light and day. Obviously, you know as a person, but the pineal gland is shooting off some melatonin at a time where it doesn't line up with, firstly, when the sun is going up and down or when you need to be productive. So let's put your pineal gland on a couple of training wheels and teach it how to appropriately release melatonin. The other things that impact melatonin are not just when you go to sleep, but make sure when the sun's up, you're up. And that involves setting up an alarm. And I don't care if you're really tired, get out of bed and expose yourself to that sun. And the other thing is about making sure you get adequate oral intake in the daylight hours, because your gut is a really strong factor in appropriate melatonin excretion. So that 2 or 3 month period where you have melatonin is prime time to do everything to teach your brain this is when melatonin needs to exist. So more than 3 months, I'd just say, we've given it a go. You're still not sleeping. Let's try something else.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned a light box, and you've also mentioned the early morning sun. I'm a great believer in lifestyle medicine and behavioral approaches as the foundation for any problem, including insomnia. And I believe that the key to a good night's sleep actually starts with a morning routine. And, you know, even on an overcast day, the amount of light that is getting to your eye is 10,000 lux, right? So even when it's cloudy and drizzly, you know, it's 10,000 lux. And, you know, most light boxes, I think, struggle to consistently give 10,000 lux. So really, if you can get into the sky, if you can look at the sky for 10 minutes, you have set yourself up for a great night's sleep. You've woken yourself up, and you've set the alarm clock for your brain to say, right, in 12 to 14 hours, I need to start secreting melatonin to try and get a good night's sleep. So the morning routine is as important as the evening routine in setting you up for a good cycle and a good sleep, especially if you have ADHD.
Well put, Fergal. And that goes for other lifestyle factors like caffeine and nicotine. As if you have that later in the day and you're giving that signal to remain awake, that's going to push out that circadian rhythm further as well.
Yeah. Now, I mean, this actually brings us on to the other idea, or one of the important issues that I face, that a lot of people, certainly with potentially adult ADHD, they use alcohol and cannabis to self-medicate some of their symptoms, especially the insomnia. But what's your view on the role of these substances in self-medicating ADHD?
It's common, and often people don't get an appropriate ADHD diagnosis because they're precluded from the assessment while they're in the midst of a substance use disorder, especially with alcohol and cannabis. On the other side, a lot of people with alcohol and cannabis use will have inattentive symptoms because of their alcohol and cannabis use. So it's a very commonly occurring request to either manage someone's substance use disorder when they have ADHD or consider ADHD when they're using alcohol and cannabis. But that sleep architecture is just sacrosanct when you have ADHD.
Absolutely.
And anything that you do to alter that is going to have ramifications, not just the next day, but for the next night's sleep and so on and so forth. So making sure you're getting an appropriate amount of REM sleep and going through all of the phases of 1, 2, 3, they're really, really important to make sure that your ability to focus when the odds are stocked against you has no reason to falter. So I really, you know, abstinence in and of itself can be one treatment for ADHD. And if you're not having an effect from the stimulant medication and lifestyle factors, but still smoking cannabis and drinking alcohol, that's going to be the very obvious thing to get rid of. So I advise people as much as possible just not to do it, especially don't make it a habit.
Yeah, I mean, I cannot overstate the adverse impact of both alcohol and cannabis on REM sleep and how it just, as you say, destroys the architecture and therefore just screws you up. Manu, unfortunately, we're going out of time once again. I really would look forward to speaking with you again very shortly on further the management of ADHD. But for today, thank you.
Thanks, Fergal. I'll see you then.
That's all for today, folks. My name is Dr. Fergal Armstrong, and this has been Cracking Addiction.